In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. Today we're looking at the book of Judges from the Holy Bible, continuing into our Holy Bible book club series. First off, I'm Scott, joined today by Jason.
Howdy.
And Pat.
Hey.
And today we're looking at the Book of Judges, and my first question to you is, in this anthology of the 12 judges that we get in this book, where is the character of God in this story? Let's start with you, Jason.
Sure, yeah, so we're on the seventh book here, anthology written in Judges. Through the previous six books, God does play a pretty prominent character, speaking to Moses and telling Noah what to do. You know, he's in everybody's heads, everybody's hearts, air quotes. But in the book of Judges, like you said in that quote, it seems like every man is just living their life through whatever laws they have set for themselves. And they're living amongst the Canaanites because in the very beginning of this book, it says the battles that they did not win. So they're kind of stuck up in the mountain and they're unable to take the valleys. And at the very, I think in chapter 1 and 2, it outlines all of the different cities and providences within Canaan that they did not win. And I think it says something specifically about them having a lack of iron, which the Canaanites apparently had iron weapons and iron chariots, whereas the tribes of Israel had bronze weapons. And I thought it was kind of curious because it seems like if God wanted to really help Israelites out, why not just give them the knowledge to make iron tools?
Yeah, that seems like it would be the easiest way. Like, if they're his chosen people, then why is everyone else the ones with iron chariots and weapons made of steel, and then the Israelites are still stuck with bronze and wood? What do you think, Pat?
Where the idea of where God is at this point? It seems like the Israelites pretty much accomplished a lot of things to the point where they can just live about their own lives, not having to call God every day and be like, hey, I got this one problem. Can you help me out? And so they always have to rely on the leaders and their own best judgments, which of course doesn't exactly go very well because the other leaders have died at this point, and they haven't exactly picked a new leader, or at least God hasn't anyway, as of right now. But it's only a matter of time when the Israelites go back to their old ways of sin and just losing their own way. And it kind of goes back to the idea of leadership too. When there's a land that's conquered and everything has been taken care of, the Israelites, okay, are like, okay, what now? What's next? And they just sort of like go slowly turn back to their own ways, and that's when God has to intervene.
Yeah, you see them kind of isolating themselves within their own tribes. And I see one kind of parallel in the book of Genesis with the Tower of Babel story. Because, like, there's one point where, like, the two tribes are talking to each other, and they're trying to identify whether or not they're an Ephraimite or not. And they say, what's the word? It's like, they ask him to pronounce a word, and they pronounce it wrong. And then they say, okay, well, you're not one of us, so we have to kill you. He says, say Shibboleth. And then he replied, Sibboleth. So he smote them. So it's like maybe this is just a retelling of the Tower of Babel story in a way where everyone got too comfortable in their own isolated little families, and then that's when God had to come down and intervene and then separate them all. So maybe God is present in this story, and he is in fact responsible for all of this strife that they're going through, because like they're not getting along, so God is coming back and confounding their languages again. Because as we can see, it doesn't take that long for, one country to start speaking two different languages and then not being able to understand each other to the fullest extent.
Or
I
even
hear you.
like the idea of just sharing some stuff with a different tribe or anything like that, and even intermarriage too. That's a sin according to what some of the Israelites claim.
Well, not to jump ahead, but in chapter 9, verse 22, it does say that God sends an evil spirit into the land. And I don't recall if he was doing that to like confound or vex the Canaanites or the Israelites, but apparently he does have that power, and that's one thing that that may have been in the story of Gideon actually. But he's present, but just less so than in the other books. And I think it was in Joshua that after that magical story of the sun and moon standing still, he says that that was the last time that he really listened to the quarry of man.
So maybe that really just talks about how, or speaks to how God is just an authoritarian. All he really wants is for us to adhere to one singular power. And it was all right when they were a nomadic group traveling with Moses or with Joshua, doing everything they told them to. But once they reached the promised land, the leadership kind of divided up. Like, not every tribe adhered to one of these judges. Like in the book by in the guide by Isaac Asimov, he talks about if you took all of the reigns of the judges and lined it up, it would be like 410 years. But the Book of Judges only covers like at maximum like 120 to 150 years. So that's just evidence that all of the judges were reigning on their own time, doing their own thing among their own tribes, not like an overarching Israelite judge or leader or someone to create the laws. So after the death of Joshua, the judges didn't really have the same amount of power as before.
Yeah, and they had
Yeah.
their own problems to deal with.
This story is, I kind of read it as a crossroads between the Mosaic leadership, for Moses and the previous six books. They don't yet have a king, so it's a crossroads between like the Mosaic leadership and I guess monarchy. And right now they kind of have these tribal judges, or they could be thought about as rulers, military rulers, kind of leading things. But I think it's also important to point out what period this is taking time. And you brought up Isaac Asimov, Scott. I think he is estimating this time period to be about 1050 BC, between there and 1100 BC, if I recall. And if that is the case, this is a period when Ramses II had passed away around the time of Joshua. So the rule of Egypt was kind of over. They were no longer, ruling this land of Canaan. And what's going to be coming, the Assyrians, has not yet, the sun hasn't risen for them yet. So the judges in this book, the tribal leaders, are just having to deal with just the Canaanites, and they're not having much luck with that. The story kind of reminds me of The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, that old Western, because there's this chapter reads a lot like a nightmare. It's just like a cycle of bad things keep happening.
Yeah.
There's
It's
there's
pretty
bloody.
scattered too. Like, not every story seems to relate to the others. Like, with like the other six books that we've read, it seems like this is a comprehensive story arc that has been established. And this one, it's like four different mini stories all kind of packed in together. And then there's Samson, which is many take to be just a sun myth, which we can get into a little bit later. But yeah,
Excellent.
when I was reading through the Asimov book, he was like, the Iron Age kind of like began in its most early stages around 1400 BC. So if this is like around 1000 BC, then like iron has been around for approximately 300 to 400 years, and the Israelites are still limited to bronze because they don't have the technology yet. So
Yeah, that
like
would be handy.
if you really take the Bible seriously, you have to wonder why God didn't give them the knowledge to smelt iron if he really wanted them to go in and take the land.
Or why not give them the like design for a Smith and Wesson, the lead bullets, so they
Yeah.
could over. But that's why I thought it read like a Western. It's bloody, it's primitive, and at the end of it's a pretty repulsive story, which we'll get to.
Yeah, it's a really dark tale. I think each judge is kind of like their own. I think the Book of Judges is kind of like an anthology, like what you normally see in a TV show nowadays, like what most TV shows are nowadays. They're cinematic and they have their own different stories, like American Horror Story or Fargo or any of these things. They go through the same similar situation. It's just that they have different characters living in the shared universe and all that. That's what I kind of picked up on as I was reading this. And each judge kind of goes through the same path too, which is when they accomplish something and then they die, a group of people, in this case the Israelites, kind of lose their own faith, and they slowly decline over time until they have to bring in another judge. And so it's just this topsy-turvy kind of ordeal.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That I believe the rule of each judge in the story is about 40 years, and then they go through another 40-year cycle where they all start worshiping other gods and goddesses in Canaanite mythology. But maybe we should. The point that I was trying to make there was, it reinforces the idea that we see in Christianity today of Sunday school. You have to teach the kids young, otherwise the whole story, the whole passing the knowledge and the laws of God will be lost. So when I read this, I'm seeing that, like, well, that makes sense. If you were like the head of a church or a pastor, why you would need to have kids come in every Sunday morning telling these stories. But when I was in Sunday school, I don't remember this story being so bloody. Maybe they censored it a little bit.
Yeah, Sunday school for me was just like, okay, it's all fun and everything. It's kind of cartoony and everything. And in the end, Israelites win and happy-go-lucky. And then as we age, we're like, okay, we get the adult version of this.
Yeah.
And we're shocked too.
The Israelites. I wonder how many Christians just stick with that Sunday school outlook on the Bible and don't dig any deeper to see, like, oh, this is actually a horror novel, not a little fantasy book that you thought it was.
The Israelites do kind of win in this, but it's like an argument and a marriage. You consider all the tribes married. When a husband and wife argue, there's not really a winner per se, because you're supposed to be on the same team. And in this story, we even have like essentially a civil war starting near the end of it. But maybe we should start with just the beginning of the story with, I think it's Judah and Simon. Are they considered the first judges,
I
or
think
is it?
I don't know if Simon or Simeon is a particularly a judge, but it does mention that Judah takes over as like a military commander from Joshua.
Yeah, I read it as this word they used. Judah asks his brother to join lots with him in fighting the Canaanite. And I think they're specifically going to fight this guy named Adoni Bezek.
Yeah, and it's also unclear whether it's talking about an individual named Judah and Simeon or the tribe Judah asked their brother Simeon tribe to, take out this other tribe because the Bible uses eponyms a lot, so.
Right. I just thought I was kind of curious. They use that word lots to join lots because that kind of is a word tied to myth. And Plato discusses that in Book Republic in chapter 10. And when you're picking a lot in life, you're standing before the three necessities of fate and you're choosing what you want to be reincarnated. I guess they weren't able to edit that aspect out because that would definitely tie into the older mythology of multiple gods and goddesses.
I'm sure like just digging into some older languages would reveal a lot more about that term and how it was used back in the day.
Yeah, it's kind of like how Will discussed before, just like knowing that there's so much lore that there's hardly enough information to go over, and we have to constantly just research it.
Another random little bit when I was reading this book and the last one, it just like talks about two places called Megiddo and Endor, and like those are planets in Star Wars. George
I
Lucas
know.
read his Bible.
Certainly got some references there. So, which of the judges do you think was probably more suitable? Like the strongest ones, I would say, or wiser?
I don't know, they all kind of have like a different aspects of them.
I would venture to say the earlier ones because they were closer to Joshua and that and the direct descendants. So maybe Judah and this guy Othniel, just butchered his name. But they do some pretty gangster stuff. All of them do. Like they're in chapter 2 and 3, I think. They cut off like the toes, the big toe and thumbs of one of these Canaanite kings. They just, that just reads like a OG monster movie right there.
That's eye for an eye, toe for a toe.
Yeah.
And then this other guy, the other judge, Ehud, this is in chapter 3, he goes up to a Moabite king. Who's like sitting in his summer parlor with the door shut? Some suspect he may have been like masturbating in there. But this guy, Ehud, goes up in there and just sticks a blade like right through this key. So that was also pretty gangster.
Yeah. There's a lot of gangsters in this one. I mean, even after the story of Gideon, where they decide they're going to follow his children, but the problem is he makes too many children. And one of his kids gets greedy, kills all of his brothers, So he would inherit the title of judge or king or ruler or whatever they were calling themselves at the time. So,
I mean, before chapter three ends, before we get to even chapter five, there's already 10,000 Moabites that were, let's see, how's it describe them? They were lusty, thirsty sons as well as valorous, thinking they controlled their own fate.
I think in my copy it just calls them the sons of Belial. Does that sound right?
Yeah, so yeah. That I think is one of the Canaanite gods at the time.
Actually, that's a mistranslation. Asimov talks about this a little bit too, where the word Belial just means like worthless opinion. So when they're calling them like the child or the product of worthless opinion, they're just saying these guys are idiots. They're what they believe doesn't really matter. So it's like a reference to the gods that they believe in, but it's not actually talking about a specific deity. Same when it talks about Baalim and Asheroth or Ashtaroth. Like Asheroth literally just means like female deity, like one of the goddesses of the Canaanite pantheon. So when a lot of people read the word Asheroth, they're like, oh, this is talking about another specific god that's terrible, but it's just another umbrella term for like chief goddess and chief god is Baal, and chief goddess is Asheroth.
A different rank, so to speak.
Yeah. It'd be like comparing Zeus to like Ares or Aphrodite.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to mention that one of the reoccurring themes in this anthology is that ties into that quote we opened up with, that men without God will be left to their own devices.
Right.
And that doesn't seem to work out. And I think that's what the anthology is trying to point at, is that these people need a unifying law, unifying God to live under. And that's the trap that you mentioned of Ashtaroth and Baal, Belial, that they keep falling into, is worshiping other gods. I don't know how that was working out for the Canaanites, you know, where if those gods and goddesses were seen or perceived as helping them out. But in the Christian myth here, we have only Yahweh is the way.
Yeah, that's the thing that I've noticed about reading through the Bible, is that the actual scripture itself doesn't say much about how terrible all of these other gods are. It focuses more on how terrible it is to, you know, depart from your own people and worship other gods when your society is trying to establish something here. And like, the only thing that they feel holds them together is their deity they call Yahweh, the jealous God. And as soon as one person defects from that, then that just brings down the whole house of cards. It doesn't work if you're not worshiping the same God, so you're exiled. But there is like the part in Genesis where it talks about how Moloch is the chief deity that demands child sacrifice of everyone's firstborn. So, you know, it's hard to say.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to live like in a society where there was human sacrifice. I think that'd be pretty rough.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what these guys are, this tribe of Israel's trying to do. It's showing the story of how a law is implemented in the old ways. You know, it's a little bit different than like the Hammurabi code, but you know, when a new law is coming out, you know, it might be a bumpy road.
Yeah.
That people might break it and adhere to it and break it and just follow that cycle.
And it's not even about finding the right laws. It's just about having a set of laws. Like, laws in existence in and of itself is more important than having specific laws for social justice. Like, the Canaanites were sacrificing all their firstborns, but they probably had a pretty cohesive society if it lasted, you know, all throughout the Bronze Age and even before in the Stone Age. Like, how old is the city of Jericho that we've discovered? Like, it's a system that works, even though it's a bad system. And I think even in today's society, we're focusing too much on throwing away the bad parts of the system, and we're not accepting the fact that we still need a system in place
that the only everyone can agree on. The only difference is trying to reform it.
Right.
Trying to reform it. And another thing that's kind of striking to me when it comes to this kind of thing is how some of the Israelites are trying to save themselves by sinning and even trying to step away from the judges, try not to get involved in them.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to, like I said, try to reform this one system that they can follow, or at the very least, multiple systems. In this case, it could be like maybe something that's highly ethical, or maybe business related, or just, I would just say ethical in general, that they would just try to sort of, I don't know how to describe it, but just sort of like mind map it, where they would take the entire system and just see which direction they would want to go into, or just have like multiple directions and see which way the wind blows, so to speak.
Yeah. Like, they're each taking their individual path. Like in that quote, every man did that which was right in his own eyes. So in their own eyes, in their own mind, they're not thinking, I'm rebelling against God. They're saying, I'm doing what's best for me and my family. But I guess you could argue that what God wants is for each man to think of themselves as a node in a network, and to look at your neighbor and, you know, show them kindness, even if they don't deserve it, so you can live in a cohesive society. You know, you won't confound your languages by ignoring and isolating yourselves. And you can find that source of unity if you, you know, unite yourselves, you know, do the work yourself. But as you can see, like, he basically says the road to hell is paved with good intentions, because look at all these judges and people following the judges. Their lives are miserable, but they're doing what's right in their own eyes. So,
yeah,
it's a good lesson.
Yeah, the idea of that doing right to each their own kind, it doesn't always work out, but taking an idea of God or the devil and saying that your laws are divined by them, I think it makes it easier for somebody to say, okay, what I'm doing is holy, or what I'm doing is evil. So it's a way to kind of create cohesion and getting people to obey in a certain way, to implement a certain behavior. So they're trying to like implement some kind of behavioral modification on their culture. And like, if you take something like addiction, if you just think, well, it's not really hurting me to do this or that, you'll most likely continue to do it. But if you think about the drug or substance you're using as like an evil thing, it might give you like some motivation to quit using it. And you can take the same thing for healthy things. If you see it as something that's close to godliness, it might motivate you. And so I think these ideas of a divine law and that there's a good and evil are, I think they're very powerful. as far as like individual psychology and group psychology.
I could also see it working in the opposite way too, where if someone's like trying their best, but they keep falling into sin or whatever, they keep using drugs, they keep doing heinous sexual acts or whatever. But, and then everyone else around them is saying, "Oh, you're a sinner, you're closer to the devil, you're evil." Like they're going to eventually internalize that, and then they're going to say, "Well, maybe I am the Antichrist." And then you get someone like Nietzsche who just embraces it fully, worships Dionysus, and says, "Yes, I am the Antichrist."
And with Christianity, it's kind of all in or none. It's all or none, because if you're considered evil, you're possibly unredeemable, like the devil. The devil can't redeem, according to their thought on it. But if you look at Eastern religions, the devil can be redeemed. It's like with Christianity, we have this idea of original sin, and you have to repent to be walking with God. But in the Eastern religion, we have this idea of original innocence that gets covered up by bad behavior, greed, hatred, and those kind of things. But you can get back to your original innocence.
Yeah, just to compare that to Norse mythology for a second, you see like all of the gods is kind of a dysfunctional family. Like they don't really have a devil in Norse mythology, but they do have Loki, the trickster, and they have Hela, and they have like a dog that they have to chain up, like a half wolf, half man. And like these are all the children of Loki, and Loki just hangs out with Thor and Odin all the time. Odin and Loki are blood brothers. They live together, but at the same time, everything bad that happens to the Asgardians and the Aesir is all thanks to Loki. So like you have to, like in that tradition, you just kind of have to embrace the devil as a shit disturbing cousin, you know?
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of Rick and Morty, how
Yeah,
dysfunctional they are, but they're still like together. They always come back. So maybe getting back to the story, we were talking about Ehud murdering a king, and then what's the deal with Delilah? Like, she murders somebody by driving a stake through their head, but isn't there something like the Song of Delilah?
I don't think that's Delilah, that's Deborah, right? Or
Deborah, yes,
yes,
you're right.
Delilah's from the Samson story.
Yeah.
Interesting. In chapter 5, verse 20, it says, "The stars in their courses fought against Sisera." I think he was the one that got killed. And that kind of ties
Yes,
back
Sisera
to
was the one
what
that Deborah killed, right?
we were talking earlier about fate. And that passage reads a lot like it's implying that Sisera was fated to die. So I don't know where the free will was in that part.
Is there free will in Christianity? I'm not sure.
Free will at all?
Well, God would want us to think there's free will, right?
So I would say that for Deborah, she is, like we said, is a writer of songs. So I would say that I don't know how to explain this properly, but
Let's just say we'll tell her story to anybody who says that there's no feminism in the Bible. There, one of the judges was a feminist. There you go.
she was one of those leaders who did not like what was really going on as far as just conquering the land and everything, and that she only wanted to rely on writing songs and just live her own life with God. And I guess the only thing that she was having trouble with was just resisting her position to resist her position in the culture as with God conquering, helping God to telling the Israelites to conquer and knowing all these great things from him. So it's sort of like she was kind of worrying about something that didn't really exist. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Where we have this constant anxiety of something may happen, but as time passes, it's a big nothing.
But I guess it comes along with the ideology that it's better to be prepared than, you know, unprepared for when it does happen or when it could happen.
Did you guys think the story of Gideon was kind of like a retelling of the Spartan myth 300?
I did notice that in chapter 7.
Yeah, because that myth would have came way before this time period. That myth would have probably been in Greece. So, but it's that story. We're jumping to Gideon that I mentioned that God sends an evil spirit into the land. So apparently, I don't know, there's these 40-year periods when God doesn't really seem to be talking to the people so much. Like, he could easily just remind every single Israelite, hey, guys, I'm here. Just like he could do, like, right now to you or me or anyone listening. But yeah. He doesn't. I don't know. Like, is he playing cards with the devil during that time? Like, does God get bored? Like, is he just watching things fall apart?
Yeah.
I would say Gideon is someone who is actually... There's actually a question in my version of the Bible, at least, where whether or not Gideon was testing God or just trying to garner encouragement from God.
What was the brief story of Gideon again? He was raising up this army to fight. God sends this evil spear into the land, and does he win these battles?
Yeah, Gideon takes out the Midianites. I think that's who his war is up against. And yeah.
There was that, and he also was offered a kingship by the men of Israel.
That's also when the angel appears to him and tells him to tear down the grove and everything.
All yeah, the special... The- special cameo.
Yeah. It seems like every book has like one sentence that's like, and an angel was there too, and then he doesn't pop up again. Let's go, by the way, there was an angel that was around that told Gideon to do this, so that's why he did it. Like, for me, it just feels like a plot device. Like, we need a reason for Gideon to kill all these people. We need it to be justified, so the angel told him to do it. I think it's the same thing with Joshua, too. When, like, Joshua appears to him and he says, oh, it's an angel of the Lord. What do you want me to do? Oh, kill the bad guys. What do you mean? That's obviously what you're supposed to do.
I'm just the messenger here. I mean, come on. Yeah.
Kill the men and the women.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole thing is a divine land grant. So they're telling this story as the justification for why they killed all.
Mm-hmm.
Good, bad, and ugly. So Gideon eventually conquers the Midianites, and then eventually things fall apart for him.
Yeah, like everything's all right, it seems, in his lifetime, but... afterwards, when they're doing the exact same thing that he didn't want to happen, because he says the line that I mentioned earlier, like, no, you're not gonna worship me, you're not gonna worship my children, you're gonna worship God. That's how we get together, that's how we do this. But as soon as he dies, they're like, oh, Abimelech, let's you're our new judge. And then he kills all of his brothers to make the divine right of the inheritance his own. So, like, the problem with the story of Gideon isn't Gideon himself. It's everybody else's opinion of Gideon. And, you know,
yeah.
If you have a great leader, and like, even if he is the greatest leader you could ever possibly imagine, if you give him all the power, that's going to turn out bad for everybody. The only thing, the only entity that can handle all of that power is, you know, the one that none of us can actually interact with or prove that's real.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was about to say that if God has all that power, everything's going to end up bad for us too.
Yeah, but like, but as an atheist, I would have to say, you know, God doesn't have the power. We all have the power to, you know, unite under God, but I don't know. It's not a great tool at this point because, you know, as we've seen in the conversations between, like, all the celebrity atheists and Christians, like Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson, like that whole debate, we're in the middle of throwing the baby out with the bathwater right now. Like, Nietzsche already declared 200 years ago that we killed God. Not 200, but close to it.
I think the real question to be asked is, can one handle God's power? If that power is given to somebody, can they handle it? Can they control it?
Well, I think the answer there is a profound no. That's where we get the power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
There's a quote that I'm not sure where I heard it, but God and the church are not going to give you their power. The people have to take that power from them. So, yeah, they end up going and falling into sin again by worshiping these other people as gods. And then we get to Jephthah.
Right.
Who's asking the Lord. It seems like he's kind of testing the Lord here. He's asking the Lord for victory in a battle. If he wins, he will sacrifice whatever he first sees exiting his house. Kind of peculiar. I don't know if he thought like his goat was going to leave the house first. But obviously, yeah. You know, why wouldn't he think it was his daughter? And then it seems like God allows this sacrifice to happen. Unlike, you know, he didn't send an angel.
Yeah.
Like he did with Abraham. He just lets it happen.
When I was reading through this, I literally expected, oh, they're going to literally just retell the binding of Isaac. God is going to intervene and save the daughter. But she died. And then, like, I can talk a little bit about Asimov's interpretation of this too, where he describes an old pagan ritual, because like at the end of that little part of the story is talking about, and all the women would lament for what was her name, the daughter that was sacrificed, like all of the women would lament her name, and for 4 days, and that was their ritual. But this is like the first time that tradition, that like ceremony, is ever brought up in biblical scripture. So what Asimov says is, you know, this could very well be just an old pagan ritual that they were trying to integrate with Hebrew tradition, in the same way that they integrated the Yule tree as the Christmas tree and all those other weird holidays like Halloween becoming a Christian holiday for seemingly no reason, but to integrate other people's cultures.
And this anthology told in Judges, it does seem to have retellings of older stories. Like we mentioned this with Jephthah and his daughter, very similar to Abraham and his son. But in this case, God's not interested. So I think that's a big distinction. And there's another part of the story later on, when we get to the rapes, that God doesn't like flood the earth. like he did with Sodom and Gomorrah, because it was almost the same story. We get there, we can talk about it. So Jephthah kills his daughter. What a mofo. and he becomes one of the judges. So
yeah, I think that's just another example of, you know, they're doing what they think is right, you know. All of the Canaanite gods want child sacrifice. Maybe he just forgot the story of Abraham and Isaac for a minute. Well, like
Asimov may have mentioned that this story of Jephthah murdering or sacrificing his daughter was to show how far they have fallen, and they don't really even know the character of their own God anymore.
Yeah. That sounds right.
Like, they don't realize that sacrificing her would have been seen as abhorrent.
Yeah, and I guess it's like God or Yahweh didn't intervene because he was like, well, this guy's already fallen. He's worshiping God, but he's definitely not worshiping me. Like, just look how he acts. He doesn't believe in me. He doesn't trust in me. He's trusting and lusting after all these other gods where he thinks will, you know, get him where he wants to be. But he's not doing the right thing, he's not taking the right path, so I can't help him. I only help those who help themselves. Even though, like, in the guy's own eyes, he's doing what's right. So the problem is really the clarity and, like, these individuals not knowing their own tradition. They have their faith, but they don't have their practice. They're going to church, and they're visiting with their priests, and they're doing all the right things, but they don't really have the proper understanding.
And I think if God is getting bored with the people by this point, he's probably becoming... probably rubbing off on his angels, because in chapter 13 verse 6 an angel appears. I forget for what reason, but it says the countenance of that angel was terrible. So maybe these angels are getting the wrong rub from God, because he's pissed off or bored with people by this point. He's like, I can't flood the earth anymore.
Yeah, I made a promise, okay? I can't do it anymore. God keeps his promises. Noah made me pinky swear.
Scott, you had some notes on the next judge, Samson.
Right. So, going back to the integration of pagan myths, much like Jephthah, Samson is thought to be a sun myth, like literal mythology about the cycle of the sun. And all of the other bits... Like, he also says that this old pagan myth probably existed before, like with Jephthah. He said that probably existed years before, but with a different individual. And, like, they altered it to make it an Israelite hero. But in the same way, they took Samson, a symbol of the sun, and they turned him into an Israelite hero. And a Nazirite, of all things. Even though they barely take seriously any of the, like, notions of what it means to be a Nazirite, except for the long hair. That seems to be, like, the only common reference. But in countless other sun myths, figures that have represented the sun have all had long hair, and their hair has been representation of the rays of the sun. And in the story of Samson, the one who's finally able to, you know, like, uncover his secret and take away his hair is Delilah, which is a derivation of the word Lila, which is the Hebrew word for night. So night, literally, is the one that subdued the sun enough to have the rays get taken away. And then when Samson's hair starts to grow back at the end, he retains all of his strength, and you see him collapsing all the buildings. And, you know, there's a bit of an inconsistency at the end where, you know, Samson dies in his triumphant attack when in other sun myths, he would continue to live and reign, and the cycle would continue on and on. But it's like the story of the passing of a day in some ways.
Yeah, I think in this story, they need him to die so that the next...
Right, yes.
Plot, the next plot point can progress. But of all of these judges, the story of Samson seems the most unbelievable.
Yeah.
Long hair, giving him some sort of supernatural strength.
Yeah, but I also really kind of like it as just a purely Hebrew Israelite legend, because it could be referring to just how, you know, the tradition of the Nazarene and the Nazarite was implemented back in the days of Moses. That was a long time ago. And now, over all of the years, the only thing that we really still keep from the Nazarite tradition is the long hair. And it's like, none of the Israelites really care about, like, the purity aspect, the not coming across a dead body, because, you know, Samson comes across tons of dead bodies, and he doesn't have to shave his hair and then become clean for 3 days and follow the whole ritual. But like, they focus on the hair because that's like the easiest requirement of what it would mean to be a Nazarite, and everything else is just like, we don't really care, but we have no problem calling you out if you're gonna call yourself a Nazarite and you're gonna cut your hair. Like, we can at least do that, right? So, like, the image of what it means to be a Nazarite, it kind of shows the change of that throughout the years. Or it's just a bastardized sun myth.
Delilah wasn't the first, wife Samson had. He had been, I think he had married a prostitute.
Yeah, he lusted after some Canaanite woman.
And she got killed?
Yeah, maybe. I don't remember now.
Well, they were talking also about the Philistines in this story, how they were preparing a sacrifice for this god Dagon.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not really familiar with Dagon. Do you know anything about that god?
Well, there's a two different lines of thinking. Some people think he is a fish god from the word dag, and some people think it's a grain god, like an agriculture god from the word grain, which is dagar, something like that. And Asimov goes with I think it's an agricultural god, because, you know, that's the main source of all of these ideas for new deities, is like, well, the chief one usually has to do with farming or fertility, something like that. And like, the idea of a fish god doesn't really make much sense, but H.P. Lovecraft has a bunch of stories about like a god called Dagon and being like a fish god, because, you know, the Cthulhu mythos is pretty crazy and wild and has a lot to do with that. And like, a lot of the original translations will like say it's a fish god or a fisherman's god, but it makes more sense to say it's an agricultural deity.
Yeah, especially because they're in the Fertile Crescent.
Yeah,
that does make sense. They're right, like, next to
the most
the
important
Dead Sea, but I don't...
Yeah, the most important part of that, though, is that Dagon is a god from another pantheon. That's all you really have to know.
It's not our god.
Yeah.
Of the Israelites. It said that when Samson tore down the temple, there were like 3,000 people on the... That seemed like a lot.
Yeah, well, a lot of the numbers seem like a lot. Like, when we were going through the Exodus, I mentioned that there's a possible mistranslation where it's like, when they're talking about the amount of people traveling through the desert, they use a word that like could mean like a military band, or it could mean like a group of 100 people or so. Like, it makes more sense to be like, oh, this was like a military band of, you know, 15 people, not 100, so the number would be like much, much, much smaller. But who's to say these little weird numbers pop up everywhere in the Bible? Even the chapter numbers are off sometimes.
Well, we save the best or worst. The author of the book saves the worst for the end of Judges, where there's this horrific rape scene.
Yeah.
I don't recall it saying who the people were, but they were in Gibeah. And this was the land of the Benjaminites.
Yeah. It's like basically a civil war between tribe Benjamin and the Israelites. But it's also kind of unclear who is represented by the Israelites at that point, because some of the tribes are still kind of off doing their own thing. So there's probably only like 4 to 6 tribes here going up against Benjamin. And then they bring them back into the congregation at the end.
After stealing wives for them.
Yeah, after completely wiping them out in a war and, you know, basically leaving only the virgins alive.
This is the craziest, and there are parallels between the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, because these two people go into a town, they're told not to sleep on the streets, and an old man takes them in, and then the whole town is like pounding on the door saying, let us have our way with the people, the visitors. And then instead of saying no in this case, like they did in Sodom and Gomorrah, they actually give the wife to the mob, I believe.
Yeah.
I don't know what the husband was doing. Like, was he just asleep or?
Could have just been overpowered. I don't know. Like, I wish we had a little bit more detail. Like, whose fault is this really? What did they do to him? Or did he just like, yeah, I don't really care. Have your way with her.
Yeah, that's the craziest part, because they have their way with her, and then she's like beaten, but she's not dead. She's not dead, but she dies the next day, I believe.
Yeah, and there's one really disturbing line where he goes to her and says, hey, get up. And she didn't. So I picked her up, chopped her into 12 pieces, and sent her to the coasts of Israel. Okay, little bit of an overreaction.
Yeah, that started essentially a civil war. That was like,
yeah,
soap opera level drama.
Yeah, and that's when Israel came in and was just like, these Benjamites have got to go. But then
they essentially wipe out the Benjaminites.
Yeah, but there's like at the very end, when they notice that like some of the Benjamites flee to this other little area, like a little mountain city or whatever. And when the other Israelites are convening to say, what else do we do with these guys? And they decide, well, maybe we should let them remarry and survive and reintegrate them into the tribe, but only if the others will have them, only if they'll come out and dance with them in this silly little ceremony.
Then they take like some wives from Shiloh. I wasn't sure who those people were.
They took the daughters.
Yeah, like I think there was like an Israelite tribe in Shiloh at the time, right? So
okay, it was among like their own people.
Yeah. I could be wrong though. The Benjaminites as a tribe drastically change in the book of Judges. That is for sure. The majority of them get cut down and they allow them to take wives afterwards. But only if the women will come out of their own free will and, you know, we're not going to give you our women. We're going to say, if our women will have you, maybe we'll integrate. But that's the extent of it.
If the women would not have them, like, I wonder what would.
Who knows? Another civil war, probably.
And that kind of brings us back to the quote we opened up at, where in this time there was no king. So they're setting up for the subsequent books that there's going to be a king. I think it's going to be David or Saul.
Yeah. I also kind of see it as like a nod to the previous leaders, like the ones that came before them. Because, I mean, the word judge isn't exactly the same translation that we use. Like, the term judge basically just means a ruler or a king. It's just another word for it. So, like, it could also be just like a little nod to Joshua and Moses. Maybe it was saying, like, these two, this is what it's like to be a king. But with the 12 that followed among these tribes, it all fell apart. So we had a king before, perhaps king afterwards. So what do you think? Would you classify Moses and Joshua as the early kings of the Israelites, or something completely different?
Well, they were different in their time. And I mean, yeah, they would be the first ones. And well, I guess I would say that they are the first ones, but they would not be considered the first judges because they did not reach the promised land or enter the promised land.
It's kind of like comparing, you know, the founding fathers to the rest of the early consecutive presidents.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to be like, well, this guy made a country and this guy just rules over the country. Oh, yeah.
And this whole story of Joshua and Judges, once they're in the Promised Land, is, I think, the period Isaac Asimov refers to as the tribal period.
Okay.
And so they're working towards, they've had these tribal leaders or judges, but now they're working towards actually getting a king over all of the tribes. I think that's what we're going to see.
Okay.
In the coming books.
Yeah. It's definitely not a standalone book. It's like, it leaves room for a sequel, Judges.
But I don't think there was a winner, like we mentioned earlier. You know, true, they are in the promised land, but they just have gone through a civil war. They've gone through these periods of, you know, dark and bloody and primitive times. That thing with Gibeah, that was pretty repulsive. So they have room to work with.
Yeah. Like, I found two planets from Star Wars in here, Mygeeto and Endor, but I definitely didn't find a Luke Skywalker. There's no true heroes in this one. Yeah.
It's kind of like Luke Skywalker.
I think he's probably the closest that we get. Yeah, I guess if we had to pick a hero of the story, it would be Samson.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
At first he wasted his own life, and then he started listening to God and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I read that the next book, Ruth, was intended to be part of this Judges anthology, but it was less dark. And so that's why they have it on a separate, whole separate chapter.
Okay.
And we're going to do that.
So then Ruth is technically one of the judges?
If not one of the judges, she's connected to it, her storyline is taking place during this 250-year period, whatever it was.
All right.
So, yeah, that's coming up.
Sounds like a standalone book.
Mm-hmm. Ruth is pretty short, so we'll probably get that out next week. Was there anything else that you guys wanted to bring up for this reading?
Other than the fact that this is probably one of the darkest books I've read so far. And it's very interesting going back to the idea of leadership and falling out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I read this as a justification for the need to continually teach the laws as they would have them. And if you don't, shit's going to happen.
Yeah, just talking about leadership for a little while, like, as someone who watches Jocko Willink's podcast a lot, it's like a lot of the aspects of leadership start to just kind of fit into place, like, the more and more I start to read about the topic. And the Bible is giving me a lot more on the topic than I thought I would ever get opening up this thing, so. Yeah, the Bible's been a wild ride. I didn't expect to start reading what I've been reading when I cracked into it. But it's been pretty interesting.
If at the very least, it definitely reinforces the need to have a strong hierarchical leadership.
Right.
And you want those people to be competent. I don't know if it goes into that, but you would hope they'd be competent.
Yeah, and there's a lot of aspects there. There's a lot of practice that it takes to select a good leader. Maybe that is what we're going to find as we continue reading, that the Israelites are going to find a method of selecting their leaders. Maybe it works better than democracy.
Yeah.
I mean, Plato gave us one version, but I don't know about that. But either way, it looks like we're done here. Till next time, you should check us out at our website, bookwave.club, Anchor, YouTube, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Till next time, may the force be with you.
Later.
Bye, lads.